Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning, and thank you for listening to the program. Here's the number, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Lots to talk about, and I'd love to hear what's on your mind, 888-914-9149. Let's get off to a fast start with Steve waiting in Elsa, Texas. Good morning, Steve. Welcome.
Morning. I have a quick question. So I'm asking about Pope Francis. Recently, I would say in January the 28th, he talked about how homosexuality is not a crime. I just want to know what your thoughts were on that.
Well, we'd have to understand specifically what he meant. I listened to the original conversation in Spanish and heard what he said in Spanish. And if we only go on what we see or hear, sometimes it can be difficult to know what was in his mind, what did he himself intend. Now, there was a clarification that came out afterward that reemphasized that, you know, he was not suggesting that homosexuality is not, or homosexual activity rather, is not a sin, because actually he does say that in midstream in his comments. So as he's talking about homosexual, and I think it's within the context of just laws in countries that discriminate against homosexuals. And then he inserted sort of parenthetically in the comment, it's a sin, but it's not a crime. So even in that statement that was so widely reported on, he does, you know, I want to be accurate in quoting him, he does say that. So then the question becomes then, well, what's the distinction? And one way to look at it, and by the way, I'm not here to try to parse his words or try to spin anything, or, you know, that's up to him. He's the Pope. Just like I have to be responsible for what I say. And if somebody says, well, what did you mean by that? Well, it's my job to explain it and to be clear as I can be anyway. And this is true for priests and bishops and popes, for that matter. So I don't want you to get the impression that I'm trying to spin anything or try to, you know, try to answer for him what he himself could only answer for. But to use an analogy that came to my mind, Steve, adultery is a sin. It's a serious sin. But it's not a crime. So unless you're in the U.S. military, and let's say you're an officer in the U.S. military, officer, in the Uniform Code of Military Justice, adultery is a crime. It's a military crime, but it's not a crime in the secular world for civilians. So except for something in the military, let's just say, it's not a crime for two people to commit adultery. It's still a sin, and it can still send you to hell if you die unrepentant. So if you want to understand his words in that light, I can see how that could make sense. If somebody were to hear his words and say, well, it sounds as though he's diminishing the gravity of this sin, is he saying that it's actually okay to do this? My hearing of what he said in Spanish suggests that that's not what he meant. But for further clarification, you'd have to ask him. What do you think?
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Honestly, I was kind of up on the fence because I remember hearing about some saints seeing those people in hell, and I was like, huh, that sounds kind of strange.
I don't make the connection. What do you mean by that?
There was a saint who went to, who saw like purgatory and also saw hell, and they said they saw those people that practiced sodomy in those vicinities. Mm-hmm. Like there was a corner for them, in their own words.
You might be thinking about Dante's Divine Comedy and the Inferno, which is where he goes into hell and he sees this. This is all, I mean, it's a beautiful, powerful, epic story that he wrote, but it's just his own idea of what what you might find there in hell. So that might be what you're thinking of. Now, it may also be that there were some bona fide saints who came, who had an opportunity to see hell, and maybe they said something like that. But I think probably more likely is that you got that from what you heard about Dante's writings, because in Dante's writings, there is a special section for homosexuals, and they are punished in a particular way there for the sin of sodomy. So just to put that in there, because that might be where you got that idea.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you so much for the clarification. Thank you.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, it's just a surmise on my part. For what it's worth, it is very edifying reading. I mean, this is not divine revelation, obviously. He wrote this as a treatise on what he thought you might experience in hell and in purgatory and in heaven. So he starts in hell, and he has a guided tour throughout hell. And then when he comes out at the end of hell, when he gets out of there, then he goes into purgatory. And after he's done with purgatory, then he goes to heaven, and he goes all the way up to the highest levels of heaven. But this is all fictional. It's just something he himself wrote. But it's worth reading. I mean, it's one of the greatest works of Western civilization literature. And if you got a, I think the translation that I've favored over the years is the John Ciardi translation, C-I-A-R-D-I. And it's well worth anyone's time to read. It's quite stimulating, and it'll make you think. Anyway, thanks, Steve. Appreciate that. 888-914-9149. How about Valerie now in Chicago? Good morning, Valerie.
Good morning. I just wanted to clarify when you're saying homosexuality is a sin, but later I heard you say the sin of sodomy. And I just wanted to distinguish between a person who might have those tendencies or be interested in someone of the same sex versus acting upon that.
Oh, yeah. That's like exactly what the church teaches.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, that's a self-evident distinction.
I would hope it would be self-evident, but sometimes I worry that people might get confused, or like divorce is not wrong. It's remarrying or being unfaithful to your spouse.
Well, actually, divorce is wrong, too. Divorce is considered a serious sin. If you're the one who pulls the plug on the marriage, that is a serious sin. If you're the victim of a divorce, you didn't commit a sin, but divorce is not
benign. If you're in an abusive relationship, if you're in an abusive relationship and you've tried to repair and you can't repair, then you could separate from your spouse.
That's true, but that's not divorce. And the church is really clear that there is something known as a canonical separation, which is exactly for that kind of situation. Let's say you have to get out of a dangerous situation. You have that right as the spouse. But I think it's maybe not as well known as it should be that divorce is not something that the church says is okay. Sometimes you have to separate, but that's a whole other topic, of course. But back to the homosexual issue, let's clarify it once and for all for people that the church does not say that the fact that you are tempted in a certain way means, therefore, that you are committing a sin, because a temptation is not a sin. It's when you act on the temptation and you deliberately do it when you know it's wrong. So the church makes that distinction between the person who has the temptation or the attraction and says nonetheless that that is it's a disordered attraction. It's contrary to nature. But the sin involves the person cooperating with the temptation and saying yes to it. And that would be true for anybody, homosexual or heterosexual. It sounds to me like that's the distinction that you wanted to hear, right?
Yeah, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Valerie. Yeah, nice talking to you. Let's see, how about Ruby in El Paso, Texas? Good morning, Ruby. Welcome.
Good morning, Patrick. I had a question for you. My friend's going through a hard time, and he's an Episcopalian.
Okay.
And his pastor explained to him the story of Job and what happened. But my friend is stuck on the part where he says that God allowed it.
Mm-hmm. And what is the nature of his complaint?
He has been wronged. We used to be co-workers, and they accused him of something really atrocious, which wasn't true.
Okay.
And even the person that he was accused by later said it wasn't true. Mm-hmm. And so he almost lost his house. He almost lost his car.
That's terrible.
And he almost didn't find another job.
That's terrible. So yeah, I'm trying to complete the equation here. So the pastor of his Episcopalian church suggested he contemplate the story of Job in the Bible, where God allows some really terrible things to happen to him. And so I want to make sure I understand. he's objecting to it because why? What is his concern or what is his argument?
He's stuck on the fact that God allowed it to happen. He's like, why did he allow it to happen? And I'm trying to figure out how to explain it to him. And I'm like, but at the end of the story, he gets, everything back and then some. Mm-hmm. And he's like, yeah, but he allowed it. He kept saying he allowed it. And I'm like, oh. And so I was stumped. And I said, don't worry. I said, I will get the answer for you tomorrow.
Well, I'll give it the old college try. How about that, Ruby? I'll do my best. Yeah. Well, the first thing I would say to him is, yeah, God allowed it. God allowed you to commit all the sins that you've committed in your life. God allowed you to. Yeah. So, just consider anything that happens in life that's painful or difficult, or God allowed all those things to happen. I don't know what his medical history is like, but did he ever get seriously sick? Did he ever break a leg? Did he ever get in a car accident? Did he ever get a speeding ticket? Did he ever lose his wallet? Did he ever, did anybody ever rear-end him when he was waiting at a red light? And these are all things that God allowed. So it's a matter of degree, not kind. What I mean by that, Ruby, is God permits painful, difficult, even terrible things to happen to us all the time. So it's just a matter of degree, because in the story of Job, there were more things that happened. So he loses his children, he loses his wife, he loses his lands and his house, and he becomes dirt poor, and he's sitting on a dunghill scratching the sores on his body because he lost his health too. But he still wins because he was faithful to God, and this is a moral tale. I believe it's true, but it's told in the story of a moral tale, a morality tale. And because of his fidelity to God in the midst of all these different trials, God, as you know, he restores everything and then some. He gets it all back and more. And so maybe the thing that your friend is hung up on is, why would God permit it in the first place? Well, I think the answer is built into the question, because he had a reason for doing it. There's a purpose for doing this, and it was for Job's welfare. Even though Job had to go through hell and high water and all the terrible things that happened to him, in the end, it was better than it was before. So when we say, well, why did God allow it? Well, he allowed it so that something better could happen to Job. Now, that's a really clear-cut example in Scripture. It doesn't always happen that way. Why does the 40-year-old mom of 5 young children die of cancer when her husband needs her and her children need her? There is no happy ending, so to speak, in a situation like that, at least not that we can see. But what we believe in is that God is working in his providence to bring good out of evil. And he allows these things to happen, in part at least, because of his creating us as free will human beings who have the ability to say yes or no. And whenever you say no, that's running the risk, of course, of causing a lot of problems for you and for other people. So this is the age-old problem of evil. That's what he's reacting to. And we all react to it because it's a very perplexing problem. If God is good and he's all-powerful, why does he let evil happen? Why is there evil in the world? Yeah. That's what he's grappling with. And so
I think you're right.
Mm-hmm. A book that he would probably really dig? It's called Making Sense Out of Suffering, by Peter Kreeft,
okay.
Kreeft.
Come on, bend it. Okay,
yeah.
Making Sense Out of Suffering. Okay.
Right.
I will recommend it to him.
Yeah, and what I just gave a little bit of a, kind of a brief sketch, Peter Kreeft takes a whole book and goes deep into that problem of evil issue. And it's quite beautiful what he does with it. I mean, he can go deeper than I could go in a couple of minutes on the radio. But the punchline to the whole thing is that the problem of evil, far from disproving God's existence, it actually points to it, because nothing could really be evil or good objectively if all that exists is just nature. You know, as the atheists will try to tell you that there is no supernatural world, there is nothing above nature. There is no heaven or hell. There are no gods. There are no angels. You don't have a soul. When you die, you're not going anywhere. When you die, that's it. It's over. So the atheistic challenge is to say, by using the problem of evil, is to say that all that exists is natural, just material things in the universe. So if that's true, here's how you can know. Here's one of the ways that you can know that it's not true. If that were true, then nothing could actually be evil. There could only be things that you like and don't like. And you may say, I don't like breaking my leg. I don't like dying of cancer. I don't like tsunamis. I don't like it when people steal my stuff. All right, well, you don't like it, but the guy who stole your stuff, he likes it. So we can't say it's evil, because there is no objective standard of morality. If this supernatural dimension doesn't exist, there can't be anything above nature, in which case the whole problem of evil collapses as an argument against God, because we know instinctively that some things are evil. We know it. We don't need a religion to tell us that. We don't need a Bible to tell us that. We just know. Stealing, killing, lying, those things are evil. So what happens is this problem of evil conundrum, it actually turns back around and points us now to a deeper mystery, which is, all right, well, we can see that in order for there to be things like evil or good, ultimately the conclusion to that series of rational proofs would lead you to say, well, then God must exist. So now we're faced with this mystery. Well, God, who does exist, he is good, he is powerful, all good, all powerful. Why does he permit this? So then we have to say, well, there must be some good reason that he foresees, that he permits us to experience these things that are baffling to us, but there's a bigger picture that we don't see. And that's where Peter Kraft can take your friend really deep and show him how to think about this.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. I wonder if, I fear that maybe I've given you more of an answer than you were looking for. I hope I didn't give you too much of an answer here.
I do not mind. I love it. I love it a lot. And thank you. I spoke to you last week, and thank you for your advice on my marriage, too.
Oh, well, I hope it helped. I don't remember what we talked about, but I hope it was helpful to you.
It was helpful to me, very helpful.
I'm glad. Well, God bless you, Ruby, and have a great day. You just made our day a little bit better by calling in today. Thank you. My number is 888-914-9149. Remember that little boy, Cruz? I got a note from his mom yesterday, and Cruz had a question. I had to do with, can a pope have a dog? Well, I heard from Cruz's mom again this morning, and I'll share that with you when we come back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code PATRICK for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. This hour is sponsored by Christendom College. Send your child to Christendom College's high school summer program, the best week ever. Get 50% off by using the promo code RELEVANTRADIO. Spots fill up very quickly, so apply today at thebestweekever.com.
Then put your little hand in mine. There ain't no hill or mountain we can't climb.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
What are you trying to tell me? Oh, is this the letter?
Wait, what am I trying to tell you?
You're telling me something Groundhog Day-ish.
Groundhog time.
Oh, is today the day?
Today's the day, yeah.
Oh,
yeah. So I have let's see where to go. Punxsutawney Phil says there will be 6 more weeks of winter. That Boo. Prediction, yeah, I know. That prediction, like it means anything. That prediction comes as he saw his shadow this morning in western Pennsylvania on Groundhog's Day. It's the February 2nd tradition that's been going on for over 130 years and really became famous because of Bill Murray.
Boo. That's a great movie,
not,
by the way.
You're not booing Bill Murray.
No, I love the movie. It's great.
Yeah, it's like it comes around every year.
Do you ever have deja vu, Mrs. Lancaster?
I don't think so, but I could check with the kitchen.
Yeah, and every year when we talk about this, I talk about the town where this movie was filmed, and I was there because I gave a seminar there, and it's up in kind of northwest of Chicago. And it's a little town. What's it called? It's going to come to me. It's near Round Lake, I think. And it's, where is it?
Yes, I knew it before you said anything. And now it's escaping my.
It's escaping my, yeah. It's Woodstock. That's where it is. Right. It's That's Woodstock. Right. Yeah. And I'm telling you, if you go there, you will see all the things that you see in the movie. You'll see the boarding house, the big old house. You'll see the street. You can stand. I stood on the, well, not the front steps, but I stood on the walkway. And you look down the street where he sees out the window every morning.
Ned Ryerson.
And as I recall, and I say this every year too, so I'm in the spirit of Groundhog Day. I'm saying it again. The spot where he steps off the
Watch
curb,
out for that first step. It's a doozy.
That's the place. As I recall, there is a plaque. There is no pothole there, but there's a plaque where the pothole was. So anyway, it's cool. If you ever, you know, want to take a drive, Woodstock, Illinois is where it all happened.
Am I right? Right.
You came prepared for this, Cyrus. I can tell.
Yeah, I don't mind celebrating Bill Murray movies like this.
No, I think it's great. So anyway, yeah, so it's kind of northwest of the city and it's cool. So, all right. Anything else on the Groundhog Day thing?
Gosh, you're an upbeat lady.
Gee, thanks. 888-914-9149.
Tell us about this kid.
I'm going to. I'm trying to get to it. Here he goes. So this is, a follow-up note, and this is from the mom of, a little guy named Cruz. And I read an email that she sent yesterday. Cruz is thinking about becoming Pope someday. Awesome. And he wanted to know if popes are allowed to have dogs. So if you didn't hear my answer to that deep theological question, just go back to the show archives from yesterday and you'll hear it. So Cruz's mom was kind enough to write back and she says, Patrick, many thanks for answering Cruz's question concerning dog ownership among popes. He was so excited to hear the verdict and has been busy considering possible names for his dog. Should the Lord call him to this vocation? Perhaps one day the church will be guided by Pope Patrick. That would be cool. I offered up the name Cyrus to him as a possible choice for the Holy Pooch. Together, they could spread the good news, throw a plug in or two for Relevant Radio, and enjoy every Tuesday feeding the hungry tacos. Cruz hasn't quite developed a taste for them yet. They're too pricey, he says. He says, or she says, your household name for Cruz as well as my other children, although Cruz and I would listen to you on our drive to preschool together every morning. Can you imagine that, Cyrus? A little preschool guy is digging this program. That's great.
It is awesome. Yeah, I love it.
So she says, and I know her first name. I don't know her, but I know her first name from her email, but she wants to go by Cruz's mom, so that's how we'll leave it. So Cruz's mom says, he would often make comments such as maybe Patrick should be president and Patrick's going to get a lot of presents for Christmas because he's so good. I like this guy. I really like this guy.
Yeah, this is all right.
Yeah. In fact, she says just a few weeks ago, our home was filled with palpable excitement when we received a rosary from Relevant Radio in the mail. Cruz was running around exclaiming, Patrick sent us a rosary. Patrick sent us a rosary. He even greeted his dad outside upon his arrival home and pulling into the garage, waving his rosary from Patrick. That's awesome. Needless to say, our family, she says, listens to Relevant Radio often. I was poorly catechized growing up, and so I'm thankful, I am so thankful that with the help of Relevant Radio, my children are learning the beautiful truths of our Catholic faith from an early age, and myself from we'll just say a slightly older age. Many thanks again, and may God continue to bless you in the work of Relevant Radio and to help spread Christ's goodness and truth and beauty. Now, there is a P.S. here from Cruz's mom. She says, if I could ask for your prayers for Cruz's dad, Joe, I think that means granddad or grandfather. He was just admitted to the hospital on Tuesday and will begin treatment soon for an aggressive lymphoma. He's a very holy man and has offered up his sufferings these past few months, aided by faith and the support of his beautiful wife, Grace. With a spirit I'm completely in awe of. Thank you. So I guarantee you that, Cruz's mom, we will indeed pray for Joe. And thank you for letting us know about that prayer intention. And please tell little Cruz, if he might be listening right now, but please tell the young man hello for me and Cyrus. You want to say hello to Cruz, Cyrus?
Hey, Cruz, thank you for listening. Isn't this beautiful? I love these Catholic families that are sharing their faith so joyfully with their children. And it's not, you know, our faith isn't something that we hide or hold back. Right. This is something we need to have a big open arm embrace and bring our kids in early and plant these seeds. So, because everyone is on a journey and there's ebbs and flows, but as long as that foundation is strong,
That's right. It
helps a lot.
Man, you're good, Cyrus. You should get your own show.
I've been listening to this this show in the afternoon. It's called The Drew Mariani Show. It's awesome.
Never heard of it. All right. Well, hey, Cruz's mom, thank you. Cruz, shout out, and we will certainly pray for Joe. All right, 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Sophia, who's waiting in Chicago. And Sophia, they told me that you're 8 years old. Is that right?
Yes.
Well, hello there. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. My question is, were dinosaurs alive in Adam and Eve's time?
Were dinosaurs alive in Adam and Eve's time? I don't know, but I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is because the science that looks at the age of things, like the age of rocks or fossils. You know what a fossil is, I'm sure, right?
Yeah.
So we have scientific ways of determining how old some of these things are. And the fossils that we have are millions and millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of years old. And there's no evidence that the science has found that says that there were human beings on planet Earth that long ago. Now, the Bible tells us that God created Adam and Eve in the garden. And so we know from what the Holy Bible tells us about how God created our first parents, Adam and Eve, because the whole human race comes from those two people, and they were in the garden originally. But the Bible doesn't give us any like scientific details, or it doesn't give us any historical details having to do with history in the way that, you know, like a scientist would look at. So what we do is we trust in God's revelation in the Bible. We know that he did create all the things on planet Earth. We know that he did create Adam and Eve, and he placed them in the garden. And we know that they committed the first sin. I'm sure you know about those things, right? When Adam and Eve ate the apple. Okay. So we trust in what God has revealed to us, and we know that these things did happen. But in the Bible, it doesn't tell us precisely how they happened or even when they happened. It just tells us the details of the truth that they happened. So what we do is we use both what God has revealed to us in the Bible, and we look at what our scientific studies can tell us about, like, the age of fossils and things. So based on that, it doesn't seem as though there were any human beings, you know, Adam and Eve and beyond them. Doesn't seem that the science shows that there were any human beings long ago when there were dinosaurs. So that's why I don't think that there were dinosaurs when Adam and Eve were around.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a deep question. I like the fact that you're thinking about these things. Do you have a Bible or like a children's Bible or something?
Yeah, I do.
Is it illustrated with pictures and things?
Yeah, it is.
Those are great. I had one when I was a kid. I don't know if I still have it around somewhere, but it was a lot of... I found it very fascinating, like the pictures about Noah's Ark and the Ten Commandments.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty interesting.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you a question that I ask most of the kids who call in who are about your age, and that is, have you made your first Holy Communion yet?
I'm about to in May.
Congratulations. That's great. I'm happy for you.
Thanks.
Well, do me a favor and say a little prayer for me now and then and all of us here at Relevant Radio. We'd sure appreciate that. All right. Nice talking to you, Sophia. Thank you. 888-914-9149. Cyrus, it'd be interesting to put together a, I don't know, like maybe a best of show where it's
all
just
kids.
All kids.
Uh-huh. I was just thinking the same thing.
That would be cool. And all the kids out there can say, did I make the cut? Am I in that best of show? We could get a lot of those calls in because they don't typically last a long time. So put a little mark down.
You got it.
Yeah. Here's a note just came in. And who's this from? This is from John. And he says, Dear Patrick, making homosexuality a crime is not necessarily a bad thing, as you seem to agree with Pope Francis. It is. Careful, John, because I didn't say that. I didn't insinuate that either. I'll come back to that. We should have blue laws and laws against blasphemy, for instance, and the road back to a living faith probably entails the faithful caring enough about sin to advocate for them for those kind of laws. The law is didactic. It is a false presumption that African countries with laws against homosexuality are unchristian and more interested in persecuting gays than protecting and forming the innocence of children. If there were unjust penalties associated with it, you could call for those to be corrected sincerely, John. Okay, John, thank you. You read far too much into my comments than were really there. I simply quoted what Pope Francis said. Those are his words. And I used the parallel of adultery to try to make the point in our own experience that there are some things that are grievous sins that are not crimes. I mean, that's a fact. So don't read too much into this. Personally, I think we can trace a great deal of our collapse societally to the fact that some of these laws were jettisoned, you know, laws that restricted certain activity. I mean, look at how dramatically, I mean, you don't need me to tell you this because you're already well aware of it, but look at how dramatically altered our society is in terms of its attitude toward things that were universally regarded as sinful, sodomy being one of them. So I think you leapt to a conclusion by assuming that I think that it's not necessarily a good thing to have laws in place that restrict certain things. I was simply quoting what I heard Pope Francis say in Spanish in that interview, or at least the question that was asked of him. Hope that clarifies it a little bit. Thank you. Let's see. I want to make sure we have time before the break. Yeah, let's go to John now in Berwyn, Illinois. Hi, John. They say that you're 8 years old, too. Is that right?
Yeah.
Awesome. So you're the second caller after the young lady who called a minute ago. She's also 8 years old. So this is two back-to-back. That's great. So what's your question, John?
So my question is, in some cultures, can priests be married? And why in America, priests can't be married? Also in other cultures.
Yeah, that is another really great question. I think this is the hour of eight-year-old power with all these great questions. So let's put it this way. Everybody, the church says that every man and woman who wants to get married, who's able to get married, so like, you know, your mom and dad are married, and your dad couldn't get married to someone else because he's already married, you see, so he's not eligible, he's not able to get married to somebody else because he's already married. Some people have other difficulties. So let's say somebody who has a mental illness or something could not get married because that person doesn't have the ability to be happily married. So the reason I'm telling you this is because the church says, the Catholic Church says, that everybody who is able to get married and doesn't have something preventing them from getting married can get married. It's something that God ordained, Adam and Eve. So we have to start there and say that marriage is good and God created it, and people are free to choose it if they wish. Now, Jesus said that there are some people who are called to not get married for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. So that would be Catholic priests. Not just Catholic priests, but we're going to talk about Catholic priests here. Now, Jesus said this in the Bible in Matthew chapter 19. And you, if you want to read that, if your family Bible is around, look in Matthew chapter 19, and you can just begin reading in verse 1. But Jesus said, some people, they renounce marriage, which means that they decide freely to not get married so that they can serve the kingdom of God. They can serve the church. And he says, this is not for everybody, but to those to whom it is given, you know, this call, they should accept it. So what this means is that the men who want to be priests in this country, not just in this country, but just in the Catholic Church, in the Roman Rite of the Catholic Church, or the Latin Rite, when they make the decision to become priests, they freely choose not to get married. So this is a discipline. This is a custom in the church. It goes back, you know, in some cases, all the way back to the time of the apostles. And so the man makes this decision. I want to serve the church. I want to serve Jesus with my whole dedication, and therefore I'm not going to get married. And that's a free choice. So he chooses that, and then he becomes a priest. Now, in some situations, there can be married men who are already married, and even maybe even have children by then, and they can become priests. And there are certain rites within the church that permit this. Now, in the United States, it's very rare, but you will even see that here. If, let's say, a man is a minister in the Lutheran Church or in, like, the Anglican Church, the Catholic Church says that if you become Catholic, you could be ordained a priest, even if you're married. So there are some situations where it is allowed, but it's not very common. And as you say, in other countries like Greece, Russia, other places like that, the different Catholic rites that permit married men to become priests, you'll see some of that there. And then the Eastern Orthodox churches, which have broken away from the Catholic Church, you'll see some of that there as well. But to finalize my answer here, John, a married man can, in theory, be ordained a priest, but a man who's already ordained a priest can't get married. So according to the church's rules, it could happen one way, one direction, but not the other. Does that help clarify it a little bit more?
What? Mm-hmm. What? Could you say that again?
Yeah, is that a little clearer? Do you understand it a little better now?
Yeah, but I only have one more question for you.
Okay. I'm ready.
I heard in the story of Adam and Eve, Adam and Eve had three daughters, and one turned on the other. But what happened to the third one?
Well, we know from the Bible the names of three of their children, but they were sons, not daughters. So you had Cain and Abel and Seth. Now, Cain, if this is what you're thinking about, he killed his brother Abel. And Seth, we know those three. We're also told that Adam and Eve had many other children, many, many other children. We don't know how many, but they had other children, boys and girls. So the Bible doesn't tell us a whole lot about that first generation of children other than Cain, Abel, and Seth. So those three you can read about in the book of Genesis in the Bible. But as far as the other children are concerned, we really don't know too much about them. That's a great question, John. Thank you. Hey, did you make your first Holy Communion yet?
Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah, also, you're probably wondering why I'm not in school. The reason why is I'm a little sick.
The reason why is what?
I'm sick.
Oh, well, hey, I hope you get better soon, John. Really nice talking to you. I was wondering why you weren't in school.
What are you doing for dinner?
Something else.
Then put your little hand in mine. There ain't no hill or mountain we can't climb.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
I got you, babe.
This song is maddeningly catchy.
Oh, you're not done
hearing
it either.
I remember when it was on the radio. I bet I'm not. Okay, fair enough. Let's press on 888-914-9149. Let's go to Thomas now in Chicago. Thomas, you're not 8 years old, are you?
No.
Okay, because that would be wild to have 3 8-year-olds in a row. But anyway, welcome, Thomas.
Hi, Patrick. I just wanted to ask, since we're on this topic about Genesis, Adam and Eve, Garden of Eden, like more of not just like about the what, but like the and the when. You mentioned something about the when, and but what about the where? Where was the Garden of Eden? Does the Bible say it? And scientists have any idea? I've heard that some scientists say that man originated somewhere in Africa, southern or south central. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, the Bible refers to the Garden of Eden as being in between the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers. And so that would situate it in what is now modern day Iraq, kind of a weird place. Of all the places on earth that I would have thought the Garden of Eden would be, it wasn't there. Of course, it was probably a lot different then than it is now. But that's what the Bible says by way of reference. Now, you know, we'll never know in this life. There's no way to locate the Garden of Eden. It doesn't exist in the sense that it did then. So it's not like they could ever find it. The Bible talks in Genesis 3 about God stationing a cherubim, an angel, with a flaming sword that turns in every direction to stop people from coming back into it. But I think that's just a way of saying that that state of idyllic paradise ceased when Adam and Eve committed the sin. So there is no Garden of Eden there to find in the future. The reason I say that is what I'm driving at is there's no way science could ever locate it. There's no way science could ever say, oh, we found it. Here it is. Look, here are the remnants, because they're not there anymore.
So it's more like talking about the fall of man, the spiritual sin, spiritual decline.
I'm not sure if I understood the question. Could you rephrase that, please?
Is it more just like what is it? What's the term for that? Like allegory or like a story, a fable? About
No. The story of Adam and Eve is true. It's a real historical event. They were real historical personages. God really did create them directly. The whole human race comes from those two people. So yes, they were in an unfallen state prior to their sin. And you know what exactly was the Garden of Eden? The Bible doesn't really tell us. We can speculate, but. But what it at the very least was a place of pure bliss and natural happiness that they enjoyed because there was no sin yet. Go ahead, Thomas.
Didn't Adam and Eve, like scientists say, like the evolutionists say, have predecessors that were sort of human, like humanoid?
Well, if you're referring to like Neanderthals and Australopithecus, also known as Java Man and other things like that. Sure, we have scientific evidence that those creatures existed, but at some point in history, God directly created human beings, Adam and Eve, our first parents. So that much is true. Now, the Bible doesn't give us the details exactly of, you know, in a scientific manner at least. We have how it's explained to us in Scripture about God taking the slime of the earth and breathing into this image of a man that he had fashioned, and by breathing into his nostrils, he breathed life into him. I mean, that's the way it's told to us in the book of Genesis, but the church doesn't require that you understand that in a strictly literal sense. I mean, it is literally true that it happened, but what were the processes that God employed for that to happen, we don't know with certitude. One thing we do know is that at a certain point, God created human beings.
And the religion of the first, like Adam and Eve, were they Jewish or were they?
No, they weren't anything, because the primordial relationship that they had with God was not based upon a religious observance. So religion, and even the word religion, refers to what man's public duty to worship God, and then the way in which you go about doing that, that's what religion is referring to. So the first glimpse of religion would be where where Cain and Abel are offering sacrifices to God. That's where we first see religion, because they are formalizing their respect for God, and they're doing it in a ritualistic way. And there's nothing wrong with the word ritualistic, and it's not a bad word. They were formally doing something to demonstrate their honor that they were giving to God. And you know the story. So Abel was offering the animals that he had dominion over. Cain was offering fruits and vegetables, a lot less valuable. But that's where we first see religion. But Adam and Eve did not have religion per se. They saw God face to face in the garden, in a certain sense at least. They communed with God, but there was no formal practice of worshiping God with Adam and Eve. We really don't see that until Cain and Abel. Now,
they even saw the angels?
We're not told that, so we can speculate. Maybe they did. We do know that God stationed an angel. We see this in Genesis chapter 3 to prevent anybody from coming back into the Garden of Eden. But whether or not Adam and Eve could see that angel, it doesn't tell us.
Very fascinating.
I agree. Hey, there's a little book about 100 pages long written by the late Pope Benedict XVI when he was still Cardinal Ratzinger. It's called In the Beginning. And it's a theological reflection on this and on what Revelation tells us about how God made the cosmos and situated Adam and Eve in the garden. So if you're interested in a really fascinating discussion of that, I would recommend that book. It's called In the Beginning by Joseph Ratzinger.
In the Beginning. But I understand, I think in the Bible, there's two versions of Genesis, and there exists from the era even more versions.
Well, okay, if you read Genesis 1 and 2, you have two descriptions of the same series of events, and they're slightly different. They're not contradictory. They're just different details are mentioned. Mm-hmm. So if that's what you're wondering about, so Genesis 1 and 2 is where you'll see that. But sure, think about this. This reality of Adam and Eve and the fall and everything that happened— can you even imagine? I can't, but can you even imagine how much they must have talked about that among themselves for generations upon generations? I mean, what more important thing could you talk about? You know, hey, Dad, tell us that story about when you got kicked out of the Garden of Eden. Mom, why did you listen to that snake? How come you listened to that snake? Can you imagine the conversations around the dinner table this family must have had for eons? So my point is, the reality of what happened was passed down orally forever. So what this means is as the human family began to grow and proliferate and spread out and populate far-flung areas, they all knew this story because they had all been told this story. So what you see is after, you know, countless, who knows how many thousands of generations, they still knew the story, even though some of the details became a little bit hazy, or some of the some of the other aspects might have been a little bit modified over time. But this is why, this is what's interesting. Throughout the whole world, everywhere you go, however far back you go, human beings know the story of Adam and Eve. The Native American Indians, they know the story of Adam and Eve. When the Jesuit missionaries were working with and evangelizing the Native peoples in what's now upstate New York, so the Hurons and the Mohawks and the Iroquois Federation, they knew the story. So when the missionaries got there and they learned the language, they were astounded to find that these people who had had no contact with any European people to speak of, they already knew the story. They knew the story of the flood. And this is true in other parts of the world. So to your question, I'll have to leave it at this, Thomas. Yes, there were many different accounts. One of them is known as the Gilgamesh. What's the word for it? The Gilgamesh, I forget the term. There's a certain term that's used with that, which is a slightly different version of the flood. But it's that common human memory that is everywhere in the world, knowing about Adam and Eve and the flood and things like that. So it's an amazing thing when you think about it. And even today, here, look at us. We're talking about this in the 21st century using modern technology. So I agree with you. It's fascinating, and I love thinking about this stuff. That's why I think you're going to like that book by the late, great Joseph Ratzinger, Pope Benedict XVI. It's called In the Beginning. I think it's about 100 pages long. So it's an easy read. Well, maybe not an easy read, but it's a good read. Thanks. I'll be right back with Hour 2 right after this.
Don't you have some kind of a line that you keep open for emergencies or for celebrities? I'm both. I'm a celebrity in an emergency.